This is Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast about motivation and inspiration. Ever wonder what drives people to do what they do? Join me as I connect with a variety of people who have great stories to tell about what inspires them, ignites their passions, and leads them to make a difference in their work and the people around them. This is episode 40 of Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast about motivation and inspiration. And on this episode, I'm happy to say that I'm going to get to chat with Andrew Campbell, an Ontario educator who wears a lot of different hats, actually. I've known Andrew for a little bit now, a few years, and I've had the chance to meet up with him face to face, spend some time, chat. And I can say that Andrew has a true passion for his work as an educator. He's also a father of three boys. He's a writer. He's a blogger. And I have a distinction between the two that maybe Andrew and I can talk about. But anyway, Andrew wears a lot of different hats. He's very passionate about his work from my perspective. And he always goes deep in his discussions about education. So if you're looking for a surface discussion, then Andrew's not the person to be talking to. So episode 40, I made it this far. I hope to continue. And it's Andrew Campbell this time. So Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Roland. We should probably say that this could potentially be your last podcast. I've done absolutely no preparation at all. And I was thinking this afternoon that if there was like a countdown clock like they do for Armageddon, then probably mine is, maybe 3 minutes to midnight right now about the chance of me saying something that's going to, end the podcast. So, I'm going to try and be spontaneous and off the cuff without getting myself in too much trouble.
Okay, that sounds good to me. But that raises a couple of things that I want to say. So, number one, this business of preparation for my podcast, I really... Like I'm honored that people would think that they might need to prepare to speak with me or on this podcast, but I don't see it that way. And then the second thing is, I think that if you were to say something to get yourself in trouble, it would have happened long before this podcast. So I don't think we're in any kind of trouble. And you know what? It's not live, so I can always edit out the good stuff, so to speak, and save that for a whole other time. Maybe sometime when I need something from you and I can call you up and say, hey, you need to help me. And if you don't, I've got this really incriminating information that we got that evening that we chatted on the podcast. So I'm totally cool, Andrew. I'm totally cool.
It's a good point. And I'll try not to give you too much ammunition.
Okay, thanks. So Andrew, tell us what you currently do as an educator.
Currently, I am teaching a grade 5-6 split grade class, and I'm teaching at a school in Brantford, Ontario. I've been at that school for, maybe 8 years now. Most of my teaching career, I taught grade 7, grade 8, and moved to that school. They asked me to drop down to do grade 4, grade 5, and now I'm doing 5-6. I'm still learning a little bit about the junior grades, but I really like it. It's an interesting difference for me.
Awesome. And tell us, have you always wanted to be a teacher?
No, not at all. In fact, that's always something that's in the back of my mind that I was reading last week about this thing called the imposter syndrome. Have you ever heard of the imposter syndrome?
I want to say that I have.
Yeah. Well, so... It was this thing that I had never really heard of, but apparently it's a common thing and people were talking about it on the radio and I wanted to look it up. And it's this idea, that people find themselves in situations as part of their adult life that they really don't feel they deserve or belong in. And I often feel that way when I'm teaching. I was never somebody who wanted to be a teacher. I mean, the teaching profession is full of people who've dedicated their lives and were teachers, wanted to be teachers when they were little kids and had chalkboards and things like that. And I was just, that was just never me. I kind of fell into doing teaching and, I love it. I think it's great. But I don't feel very teachery. I don't feel like I'm the typical teacher.
Okay, well, I need to say something. The imposter syndrome, the reason when you asked me if I had heard of it, and I was kind of like, yeah, and I didn't want to say anything, is because it's really strange for me to hear you say what you said, because I kind of feel the same vibe. I've got friends, like you said, who played teacher when they were kids. That wasn't me. In fact, when people from my other life, I call it that just because I live in a new city and I have a family here and whatever. If you told some of my high school friends or acquaintances that I was a grade school teacher, they would first like just laugh their heads off. And then they'd be like, okay, come on, seriously, tell me what he's doing with his life. That's what would happen. Because that's not the vibe I gave off when I was growing up, which is, it's fair. Like all kinds of people end up in professions and, you know, for one reason or another, I believe I'm in the right place. That's how I feel. But it's weird because just like what you were saying, I don't always feel like I don't always fit the mold of what you'd imagine a teacher to be, which kind of upsets me because then I think there should be no mold because I'm not one to, you know, play by the rules. When people tell me what I can and can't do, it doesn't really sit well most of the time. And that probably stems from all kinds of other issues. But anyway, so what did you want to do when you were a kid? What did you imagine yourself growing up to be?
Well, so, what are you going to be when you grow up was something that I got asked a lot. And I think most kids did. And probably when I was about maybe 9 or 10, I loved The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. I loved that show. I was totally into it. And I couldn't think of anything that would be better than sitting on the bow of the Calypso and going diving and just learning about marine life. And for some reason, when somebody asked me, what do you want to be when I grow up? I said, marine biologist. I had no idea why I said that, but I did. I guess it was just something that was in my heart at the time. And I just hung on to that because that was a really easy and useful thing for me to say. I mean, school came pretty easily to me. I always did pretty well in school without trying very hard. And then when I graduated from high school, I went to the University of Guelph and studied marine biology for a few years until I figured out that it wasn't really compatible with some of the other things that I wanted to do in my life. I ended up graduating with a biology degree, worked in biology for a little while. When that didn't sort of pan out the way I wanted it to, I went back to school. And at the time, I was doing a lot of coaching. I was really into soccer and doing a lot of coaching, competitive coaching. So I decided to go into phys ed, got myself a phys ed degree. And when I finished that, I thought, well, I think teaching is a good thing to do. So I went from there thinking that I would be a phys ed teacher and would coach as part of that. And that's how I got into teaching.
Very cool. So where did you get your phys ed degree from?
From Mac. Yeah, from McMaster. Okay. Yeah.
And then you did your teacher's college at the University of Toronto?
I did, yeah. I was part of an interesting program they had there called the Teaching Apprentice Program, which was unlike at the time everybody else was doing a 1 year. The Teaching Apprentice Program was offered to a few people, and it was a 2 year program. And what you did is the first year you went out and worked in schools. You got paid for it. Wasn't much.
Wow.
And you didn't get a lot of hours, but you did get paid for it. So I did that and another job. And we did that for the whole year. So throughout the whole year, every week I was in classrooms doing work, getting paid. And then after that, we were part of a separate cohort that went through and got separate instruction in teaching. And that experience was really formative for me as a teacher because when I would sit in classrooms and people would talk to me about different theories and what was going on, I had a year of practical experience in a classroom reflect it off against and be able to go, you know what, no, that's not going to work, or yeah, I think that's valuable, or ask intelligent questions and be a critical thinker about what they were telling me. So it was a terrific experience for me. It made all the difference to me as a teacher.
Okay, so that 2 year program, that is something that benefited you and your practice.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, because yeah, I was wondering what you think of the whole 1 year going to 2 year, but it sounds to me like it was a positive experience for you. I remember my 1 year in Teachers College, and I was dazed and confused. And I don't remember who I was telling, but talking about my practicums in that 1 year, my associate teachers were like, you could tell the way that they look at me. They're like, yeah, this guy's doing his thing, but I don't know if he's feeling it. And I always felt like if I had that 1 year where I could go out and be in the field and then have my practicums in the second year and learn all the theory and stuff, I think it would have benefited me. Now, if you would have asked me that, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, I would have said, no way. I'm glad I did 1 year. I got my degree. I got out. But now I think I'm the type that would have benefited from that 1 year doing like what you explain and then going heavy into the whole teacher's college thing. I think it would have benefited me and my style and my approach. But oh well, I'm here now, so it's all good.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's great about for me about being a teacher, along with many other things, but one of the things I really appreciate is that I get to really know myself as a learner. And one of the things that I know is, first of all, that I'm pretty visual. I'm a pretty visual learner. But the other thing I am is I'm very experiential. I'm not very good at listening to what other people have done and just taking it in and accepting it. I have to go out and experience it and fail and then try again and fail and try again. It's really the crux of how I learn. And so that practical experience allowed me to do all of that stuff. The two-year program is fine if it has a lot of practical experience built in. But if it's 2 years of sitting in classrooms listening to people with PhDs talk at you, I'm not sure that's going to be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, this learning style of yours, have you always understood it as your learning style, or is it something that you learned when you became a teacher? Like, I'm just trying to get at, you know, you said you go out, you have to fail, you have to try again, you have to do it, you have to fail, you have to try again, you have to do it. Has that always been the way that you've learned? And if so, have you always kind of accepted that about yourself, or has that been difficult for you?
I don't know if that's been the way that I've always learned. I haven't understood that about myself for a long time. Like a lot of people, when I was a student, I was a pretty dreamy kid. It's always really interesting to me to talk about, because just recently I've been talking a lot about cell phones in the classroom and all that kind of stuff. And one of the big things that people want to talk about is what a huge distraction they are, how kids get distracted. And I always reflect back onto my own time as a student and think, you know what? I was so distracted when I was a student. I don't know what percentage of my time I spent actually listening to what was going on, but I'm sure it was less than 30%. You know, I was dreaming what was going on outside, watching the birds, you know, doodling on pieces of paper, all that kind of stuff. I was totally fortunate in that I spent the first, 10 years of my schooling career in the UK. And there it was, we would learn and learn and learn, but none of that really mattered because at the end of the year there were exams. And so I was just the classic do nothing. And then when the exams came around, turn it on, get a good mark on the exam and move on. But yeah, I don't think I really realized what an experiential learner I was until I had to start answering questions like, what sort of a learner is this student? And then I had to think about it from my own perspective.
Mm-hmm. And you said school came easy to you, so you generally didn't have too many difficulties in school?
So I feel like it did. I think it was pretty easy. I remember being in high school in Canada and them saying, oh, you know, you should be doing half an hour of homework a night or an hour or whatever it was. And I would just never do homework. I seemed to be able to sort of take it in some way and be able to get along just fine. I mean, I certainly experienced failure in school in a lot of different ways. But I found that if it was something I was interested in and something I wanted to learn about, I could learn about it and it was fine. It wasn't too hard for me.
Mm-hmm. Now you brought up the talks that you've been having recently about cell phones and banning them and stuff like that. Have you always been someone who's been interested in using technology in your classroom?
Well, I started teaching as technology was starting to come into classrooms. And so as a new teacher and something new is coming in, you kind of go, oh, that's interesting. I certainly had personal computers and, you know, I took programming all through school and did really well in it in university. So it was an interest of mine. And then when I came into the classroom, one of the first things that my first job was teaching a self-contained behavioral classroom at Jane and Finch, at a middle school at Jane and Finch. And so I had a few kids, they were all on different programs, and technology seemed an obvious way to try and engage them. And so that's what I started doing. And then my second job, I was hired specifically because I said I enjoyed working with technology. I had knowledge of it. And the teacher said, you know what, we just got this thing in our school. I don't know what it is. It's called a network. I don't know what to do with it. So do something with it. And that was kind of the main reason I was hired. And so I went ahead and did that. And I've been working in that direction ever since.
Do you remember the first time you used the internet?
I don't think I remember the first time I used the internet, but I remember a moment sitting in my classroom. This was after school in Toronto, at my classroom in Toronto. And I was starting to think about teaching overseas. It was kind of an interest of mine. And so I had heard that they were looking for teachers in Singapore. And mm-hmm. and somebody told me, well, you know, you've got to go on the internet to get the information. And so I did that. And it suddenly hit me what was actually going on, that I had sent a message from my computer. It had gone over the wires to a computer in Singapore. And that computer in Singapore had then sent the information back to me. And it had taken, well, probably at that time, it took like a minute. But it had taken a very short amount of time. And I just remember how blown away I was by that experience. And like, wow, that's amazing that I can see something from the other side of the world so quickly. And I knew then how this was going to just completely transform everything that we knew.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Do you remember the first time you used the internet?
Yes, I do. I remember it like it was, it still is one of the most impactful memories I have as a human.
Yeah,
it totally blew me away. I remember being in OAC or grade 13, as they called it back then. And I remember walking, I went to school in the country, and it was a big high school, like 1,500 to 2,000 kids, all like in the middle of nowhere. And so at the end of the day, there were like 50 school buses in the yard. So, you know, navigating through that to get to your bus was a chore. But I remember walking to my bus with my buddy, and his dad was a doctor, and his mom was a scientist, I believe a physicist. So they had money. You know, he lived in a nice part of the country or whatever. Anyway, long story short, he tells me he was going to go home and hang out on the internet. And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? And he says, you know, the World Wide Web. And I kind of was like, dude, I don't get what you're talking about. So I get on my bus and I start thinking about this thing. And then as I'm talking to people, I remember them telling me what it was. And I thought, oh, that's neat. And for me, it wasn't something that was going to be accessible to me, or at least I didn't think it would be. But I remember being in university, my first year of university, and I got onto the email system, which I thought was fantastic. And I remember being able to send all these text messages to people. And then one day early on in my first year of university, I saw an old friend, and we were walking to class together, and he said, I'm going to go check my email. Do you want to come with me? I said, sure. So we go to one of the computer labs and we sit down, and he logs in, and I look over his computer screen, and he's got a web browser open, and there's pictures and colors and all that good stuff. And I was like, well, what are you doing? How'd you get on there? And he's like, oh, you don't know about graphical user interface? And I was like, no, what are you talking about? And he's like, how do you check your email? And so I log into the text-based system, and I'm like, this is what I see. And he's like, no, dude, let me show you how you get on the World Wide Web with a browser. And that was the first time I really remember like using the internet. And I was blown away, right? Like blown away. So that's like a new question on the podcast now that I like to ask people, because I was just getting on the internet when it was open to the to people. You know, like, I'm sure it existed for years before that, but only for a certain population of people had access to it. But I remember it clearly, and it's changed my life, really. But we're not going to get into that. I want to hear more about you wanting to teach overseas. Tell me about that interest. Where did it come from? And then how did you end up at an American international school in Kuwait?
Well, so when I was trying to think about what I wanted to do for work, there were a bunch of factors that I was thinking of. And one of the things that attracted me to teaching was the flexibility to teach anywhere. I thought that most people had to be tied to a certain geographic location because that's where the work was. You know, if you wanted to work in the auto industry, there's only certain places you can do that. And I thought that one of the advantages that teaching has is they need teachers everywhere. So you would have the freedom to choose where you wanted to teach, you know, where you wanted to live. If you wanted to go live in Barrie, you could do that because they need teachers there. If you wanted to go live in Florida, you could do that because they need teachers there. And so that was kind of in my head. But then I graduated from Teachers College at U of T. And I before I even graduated, I got hired to go teach in the Toronto District School Board. And I had done that for 8 years. So I hadn't gone anywhere, hadn't done anything, hadn't exercised this freedom that I thought was really valuable. And by this time, my first son was just getting ready to go into kindergarten. And I said, you know, if I don't spread my wings here, if he gets into kindergarten, that's it. I'll be done. I won't be able to move then. Mm-hmm. So I talked about it with my then wife, his mom, and we agreed that we would do something to go overseas. And I don't know how many people know this, but there is sort of a all over the world there are international schools, and there are recruiting fairs that start off in January, and they travel around the world making different stops to try and recruit teachers to go to these overseas schools. And one of them comes into Queen's University. And so we decided to go to that overseas teachers recruiting fair. And it's one of the most incredible experiences ever. Because what happens is you show up at Queen's on the Friday, and all the schools that are looking for teachers are in the gym. And you have about 30 seconds to go and sell yourself to any jobs that you're interested in. And then they either say, yes, we want to talk to you again, or no, we don't. You try to line up interviews. You have your interviews on Saturday. And then sometime late Saturday or early Sunday, they offer contracts to anybody they want. You either accept or don't accept. And then they pack up and they head off to fill to the next recruiting fair to fill whatever. So you arrive on Friday and you have a job on Sunday to go somewhere else. And that's what we did. It's crazy.
That is crazy. And I was not aware of that.
Yeah.
So do you remember like how many places you tried to sell yourself to, or did you just kind of go up to somebody, start talking, and that was it for you?
So we, I think in our minds, what we wanted to do is we wanted to go somewhere cool. Like we thought, well, we'll go to Europe or, you know, maybe Italy, maybe Germany, something like that. Well, of course, that's what everyone else is thinking. And so those are the most competitive. Those are the most competitive places to go, and they have their pick of anybody they want. And since we had absolutely no international experience whatsoever, and we were a married couple and we had kids, it was pretty tough for us to get into those. We ended up interviewing, let me think about this. We interviewed with Kuwait, we interviewed with Hong Kong, we interviewed with Turkey, we interviewed with a school in India. I think there might have been one more. I can't remember. We got offered 3 contracts, and we took the one in Kuwait.
And what was that experience like?
Kuwait?
Yeah.
Fantastic. I loved it. It completely ruined me for winter. I went 2.5 years with no long pants on ever. I was almost wearing shorts. It was great. I wanted to stay overseas. I would probably still be out there if we hadn't come back. It was fantastic. I loved everything about it.
Now, you only had one child at the time.
No, I took all three.
Oh, okay. You had your three kids. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
There were one, three, and five. So, yeah.
And what was the living like down there? Like, were you in a compound? Were you just free to, like, I'm assuming that the school took care of your lodging. They made sure you had a place to be or whatever.
Yeah. One of the great things about the international teaching experience is that they provided accommodation. They fly you over. So they would fly us over at the start of the contract. They'd fly us home in the summer between, and then they fly home at the end again. They provide accommodation. And then, of course, your salary and stuff like that. In Kuwait, we weren't in a compound. It was pretty pretty open. No real issues there. The only place I know that does compounds is Saudi. And and the people I've talked to who lived in the compound said it was fantastic. They loved it there. But no, we just lived in an apartment building. There were people of all different. I mean, there were a lot of teachers in the apartment building, but there were people who weren't teachers as well in the apartment building. And we were just right across the road from the school. So I could throw a rock from my balcony into the school if I wanted. It was great.
And some of the people you met there and the connections you made, do you still communicate with any of those people?
A few, yeah. Yeah, there's a few people. One of the things about it being overseas is, of course, everybody sort of scatters everywhere when it's done. So there were a few Canadians there. There's some people in the U.S. that I'm still in touch with and some of the administrators. But, it was a terrific experience all around. Terrific experience culturally. It was good professionally. I highly recommend it.
Awesome. Okay, so I want to kind of shift gears a little bit here. There's a couple of other cool things I want to talk about, but before I get to those, I want to know what generally motivates and inspires you?
So, my dad, I'm the first person ever in my family to be a graduate of university, which I tell my kids about that all the time. I challenge them to be number two. And my dad was someone who started off learning a trade, worked his way up through that, became a manager in some way, worked very hard for a long time, but would always talk about how frustrated he was with the fact that his work was, in his opinion, essentially meaningless, you know, that he did work for a company that did something that didn't really matter very much in the world. And he would always challenge me to do something that mattered, something that made a difference. And I think that was part of the appeal of teaching for me, is that if you're going to do a job, then it should be something that matters. If you're going to dedicate your time and your effort to it, it should be something that matters. And I think that teaching does. I think it really matters. I think it matters in the big scheme of things, from the idea that there are all these little things that add up to make a big thing. And I think it really matters in terms of the lives of the people that we touch. One of the best pieces of advice I ever heard about, got about teaching was from one of my teacher's college professors who said, never underestimate your importance as a teacher, but never overestimate it either. And I think that that's, trying to find that balance is important. But what motivates me is the idea that every time I'm interacting with someone, I'm making a difference, hopefully for the positive, and that eventually over time, the world becomes better because of all those things added up moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. And I know I put you on the spot there, which is part of the non-preparation, but I ask all my guests, what motivates them to do the work that they do? What generally motivates them? And it's amazing, and I'm sure you would understand, to hear all these different responses of what gets people going and what gets them doing the things that they do. Which brings me to the writing that you do. Mm. You, in my opinion, you're a natural writer. And I don't, and I'm saying that based on, I get to read your blog posts. I get to see the stuff that ends up in the newspaper. Obviously, those are polished products, so to speak. So I don't know about the process you experience. I don't know if it's a grind for you. I don't know how hard it is for you. But to me, the way you speak, like when I read the stuff you write, I can see you saying those things. So what have you always, number one, have you always been a writer? Have you always liked to write? Number two, what got you into, you know, writing for the newspapers and things of that nature?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. That's very kind. When we were talking about what motivates me, it got me thinking about the different motivations that people have for being connected educators, for doing things like podcasts or blogging or social media, all that kind of stuff. And I always find it interesting to hear why people do those things. Because for me, there's really only one reason to do it, and that's because it makes me a better teacher. It makes a difference to the kids I have in my classroom. And that's, for me, that's the only reason I do it. When I'm on social media and interacting, I'm working out ideas and trying to think about things that are going to help make me a better teacher when I go into the classroom and have to talk to kids. And the same thing when I blog, I'm working out ideas. I'm thinking about things that matter to me and I think are going to make things better in my classroom. And that's basically how it started. I think that what I found is I found that when I wrote about things, I found it out firstly on social media, that when I had to write about things and justify it, it made me think deeper about things. And I especially liked it when I would say something and somebody would push back against it and I would have to defend it, because then I had to really think about it. I had to know it much better. And so it forced me into this position of having to think about things deeply, understand it, defend it, know it. And it really solidified my beliefs about those things that I was thinking about at the time. And so then it seemed like a natural transition to me to take those things that I was thinking about and working out and try to capture them in a blog. And so that's kind of how I started blogging, and I would write about blogs. And because I was trying to challenge thinking and try to think about things in a new way, and probably as an extension of my own personality, that I have a bit of a defect about myself, in that I don't like to accept things as the way they are. And when I hear about things, I like to pull them out and tear them apart and try to figure out why they work, why they're put together that way, not from a mechanical sense, but from the sense of an idea. So I tended to write things that were intentionally provocative, to push people's thinking, to say things in a way that would provoke a reaction so that people would push back against me and then it would further my thinking. And as I did that more and more, and people would respond to it, then the opportunities came for me to start doing that same sort of stuff for a wider audience on other platforms. And that's kind of how it led into that. It was the opportunity to have a bigger audience and be provocative, because if you can do that on a blog, if you do it on a wider stage, then that drives traffic to websites and things like that. And the people running those websites, those news sites, really like that. And that's sort of how it works. That, and they would pay me. So that was good too.
Right. That's always a bonus, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So recently you've been on the radio to talk about some of the things that you've also written about. What's that experience like?
It was kind of weird. I mean, So the probably the most controversial, I don't know about the most controversial, the thing that I've written about the most that's got the biggest reaction has been some of my thoughts about French immersion. There's probably, in Canada, it's probably the biggest hot button topic in education. If you come out and say bad things about French immersion, people get very upset with you. And I wrote a piece for the Globe and Mail about it that had, I don't know, 150 comments on it. That I'm still not allowed to read any of them. I've been banned from reading any of the comments on that article because apparently they're not good. So because of that, and because I had this position as being a vocal critic of French immersion, when something came up related to French immersion, broadcasters like to have balance. They like to have somebody who's in favor of French immersion. There's lots of people who are. And they like to have somebody who's not in favor of it. And so when they look, that's me. And so that was kind of my entree into that sort of stuff. They were doing some stuff on French immersion. They said, hey, we need somebody to give the other side, to give the counter argument. Are you interested? And so I said I would. And I guess I didn't screw up too badly, because then when other issues came up, they would go, well, we need someone who can talk about this. How about this guy? He's done that before. And so then when other things came up, I got a chance to talk about it. And the thing about the cell phone ban was interesting, because that came up just a few weeks ago because there was a big media storm over a Toronto school saying that the media said that they were invoking a cell phone ban. They weren't, but that's what the media said. And so I got a call saying, hey, would you like to go on the radio about this? And I didn't really have a strong position one way or the other about it. I had an opinion, but I hadn't really taken a public position. But I was happy to help out, so I did. And then it rolled into something else, and then something else again.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens, eh? How one thing can lead to so many other things if you don't mess it up, as you'd say.
Well, yeah, and that's what. So the last thing I did was the Ontario Today call-in, and I was very intimidated by that because it was an hour, which I'd never done before. All the interviews I'd done had been, 5-10 minutes, and I was like, I'm going to be on the air for an hour. That's a long time for me to hold myself together, and people are going to be calling in. And in my nightmare scenario was me sitting there having to defend myself for an hour as people called in and talked about what an idiot I was for saying cell phones in the classroom were a good thing. My whole perspective on this was, I just want to get through this without embarrassing myself or doing anything that is going to cause me problems down the road. And I think I was able to do that. But yeah, I think managing your expectations when you're doing something new is important.
For sure. And like I said earlier, you do like to go deep. You do like to get into the weeds and really, talk it out, discuss it. Like, let's have a good discussion. When I think of you, I think of that automatically. Like, if I don't think I've done this to you, but if I really have something that I'm thinking about reflecting on and I want to bounce it off of somebody, you're always on my list, but I never get to you because I think it intimidates me.
Oh, really?
I'm surprised. Really?
Well, I can't see you being intimidated by anyone. I mean, you're pretty you're pretty smart about everything and very articulate. I don't see why you'd be intimidated by anyone.
Well, thank you for that. But
plus, you've got your sweet beard game, so there's that.
The sweet beard game. I have a funny story about the beard so thank you for saying that. But I know that you think things through based on, and people might not know, but you and I have had lots of conversations over social media. We've connected a lot, which is really cool. And so for me, I don't know about you, for me, I consider you a friend. So I can go to you. I just don't, because I think if I go to you, I know where it's going to go. And I think you're going to force me to go somewhere that I guess I've not been ready to go with some of my ideas or some of my thoughts. So take that as a compliment, Andrew, because when I do come to you, you're going to know that I'm ready to go really deep and really challenge possibly some ideas that I've had for a long time, or like parts of my identity that I'm not ready to deal with as an educator. So now, you're probably going to lock up your Facebook and your Twitter account so I can't access you, but that's what I'm thinking.
When I was growing up, my family was one of those families that would do a lot of talking and discussing, and would often be very combative about it. You know, they would always be heated discussions about it. And I would see my dad lots and lots of times be a jerk about stuff and take positions that I knew he did not believe, intentionally to provoke discussion, to test people's ideas, and because he thought it was interesting and fun to see where people's things went. He really liked to take the opposite side. And certainly in the positions that I take sometimes, and when I'm discussing things, I will intentionally be provocative and take up positions that are more extreme than I actually believe, because I think that that's sometimes necessary to move the discussion. I think sometimes you have to take up an extreme position to engage people. I was thinking about this, actually. This is one thing that I did think about before we're talking about, before coming on to do this, was that I think one of the things that I really believe is I believe that it's only by engaging in discussion and challenging each other's ideas that we develop deep understanding. But one of the problems that we have is that if our views are too close, then there's really no discussion that's going on. You know, if I think this and you think something which is different but a little different, then we don't engage in discussion, because what's the point? If, however, I say something that's completely out of left field, that's just outrageous to you, then you'll engage with me. You'll engage with me to tell me how wrong I am. And in doing that, you'll learn about what you're doing. And so there's certainly some of that that I engage in. I'm not saying that I'm not genuine in what I believe or what I put out there, but I certainly will try to be provocative and provoke discussion.
Yeah, and I know that.
Yeah, anyway.
Tell
me about your beard story.
Okay, so the family and I go away for a couple of days, and we go to a water park in the United States.
Oh, no.
And no, it's not a bad thing, actually. It's a good thing. So, and I've been meaning to further explore what I'm about to tell you, but there's something about being in a place like that for a couple of days. And I don't mean the United States. I mean a water park where, you know, you're in your bathing suit for 2 days and you're just surrounded by other people who are in their bathing suits as well. And it's kind of like a whole new level of comfort that you have to get into in order to do this with your kids, or at least that's the way it is for me. So we get there and, you know, we go into the water park and we're ready to have a blast and the kids are pumped. And we go up, I don't know how many flights of stairs to go down this family slide. And you can tell we're all nervous. We're like, we're in a new place. We've never been to this place before. We're half naked. Now we're going to go down this crazy ride, the first ride. So we get to the top and this really cool lifeguard looks at me. He goes, "Bro, I love your beard." And that was my first interaction with someone there. And it totally made me and my family just relax. So my wife is shaking her head and rolling her eyes like, "Oh God, here we go with the beard." The kids are laughing because they're like, "Dad, that's the first thing he said to you is about your beard." So me and this guy get into this discussion about the beard. And this happens all in like 2 or 3 minutes, right, before we get on this thing and go down this slide. So it was really cool that you talk about the beard game. And that's the first thing someone says to me there is, "Hey, that's a really cool beard." And then we get into, "You know what, dude, this isn't, for me, it's not fashion. I've always had a beard and it just so happens that right now it's the thing to be doing, but it's all good." Anyway, then right before he kicks us down the slide, he says to me, "So you guys like Trump?" And I kind of give him this look like I don't know how to respond. And then he does this kick that pushes this thing down like 5 flights of stairs as we're all yelling and screaming. So that's my story about the beard at the water park. I've never done that before. And I don't know about you. I don't know if when your kids were younger, you took them to water parks, or even if they existed back then. I don't know. And that's not to make it sound like your kids are really old, but I just don't know. Like for me, it's a relatively new thing. And when my wife suggested it, I was like, I don't know if I want to spend 2 days at a water park, but it was a lot of fun and I'd do it again for sure.
Yeah, no, we used to go to water parks all the time. In fact, we used to take the kids to water parks in Kuwait. That was always really interesting to see, to be at a water park and to see lots of covered women. at water parks. It was, it was an interesting experience that way.
Yeah, I imagine that would be a totally wacky thing at first to see it, because it goes against everything that you've probably grown up living here in the UK, I imagine. But I'm just assuming. I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
That
whole experience of being in a place where in a majority Muslim country that's ruled by Sharia law, and to be not that experience of being not the majority, I think is absolutely critical. And I think the more people that can experience that, the better. To be in someone in another country and having to conform to another set of rules, another set of customs, another set of social customs and all values, all that sort of stuff, was incredibly valuable in terms of realizing that the way that you knew things to be isn't the only way, and that there are a multitude of equally valid ways of living your life, and that, you know, we shouldn't be quite so arrogant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must be a totally interesting perspective to be, I'm going to call it, humbled in a certain way, thinking you come from a place where you understand how things work and you kind of know the lay of the land, and then be thrown into something where it's completely different and you have to learn to adjust. Like, you can't just tell people, you know, how it's going to be. I can't imagine. Like, yeah, you always have to, well, this is how I live my life. You go into situations and you kind of get a lay of the land and you try not to disturb too much until you're comfortable enough and you know enough in order to start questioning things or doing what you do. But I remember I went to a high school in the country, and mm-hmm. it was predominantly white folk, I'm going to say. There weren't very many visible minorities, relatively speaking, and I was one of them. And I remember when I went to university, I remember feeling strange at first because there were so many different groups of people. Like, I remember being in a university center and there was like a culturally different people in every corner of the place. And then I was with my friends from high school and they felt really uncomfortable. And I started to feel more at home because there were finally people around me who were speaking my mother tongue, who looked different like I looked different, who did things differently like I did things differently. So for me, it was like a coming home. And for my friends, it was like, it was tough for them at first. So I get what you're saying. And I think what a valuable experience, to have gone through that. Now, you're telling me that when you were in Kuwait, your wife at the time, she was with you. Now, was she affected by any of the cultural norms there, or did she just keep doing what she had always done?
So, she would probably be a better person to ask about that. But my understanding and my recollection is that most of the places that we went, We were there after Kuwait was liberated by the Americans from the Iraqis, probably 10 years, I think it was, after that. And part of the deal after that happened, when the Americans came in and liberated the country, was that they would open the country up to more American investment. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the reason why we chose to go to Kuwait, was that, first of all, it wasn't as far away as some of the other places. And secondly, there was a more familiar infrastructure there. So we, you know, mm-hmm. there was a McDonald's that we could take the kids to, and that was something that they would be familiar with. And so my understanding is that if you kept to the places that were fairly American, then she could pretty much live exactly as she would back home. She could dress the same way. There were a few things. I mean, she couldn't wear short shorts. She couldn't have bare arms, like up to the shoulder. But she didn't have to walk around with her head covered or anything like that. There were some more conservative areas where she had to be a little bit more careful. Like if she went down into the old traditional markets, then she would have to be a little bit more conservative in the way she dressed. Mm-hmm. But there were large areas of the city where it was pretty much the same as it would have been at home. Now, Kuwait's kind of a weird place in that it's a country of about 800,000 people, 800,000 Kuwaitis, but about 2.5 million people overall. So Kuwaitis are actually outnumbered, and the number of expats is huge. So it has to be open to other religions, other cultures, other kind of stuff.
Thank you for providing that information. I'm learning it all today. I didn't know any of this, so it's kind of cool to hear about it from you and to provide us with some perspective on that and the way it worked. So thanks for that.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, so Andrew, we're coming close to the end of our time together. And the big question that I like to ask people near the end is what they would say to someone or how they would assist someone who sought them out around motivation, inspiration. So if somebody connects with you and says, you know, like they don't feel motivated in the work that they're doing. It can be in education or in anything. And they kind of look to you for advice. What would you say to them?
I think what I would say is that you have to be 100% clear on why you're doing what you're doing. And if it's not something that you care about, if it's not something that you're passionate about, then you're in the wrong place. When I go in to teach, I'm passionate about it. I'm focused about it. And it's absolutely important to me. I'm not interested in wasting my time. I'm not doing this because I have to. I'm doing it because I want to, because I think it's critical that I do a good job with it. And I think that that's the kind of focus and passion you have to bring to what it is you're doing. And if that's not what you're doing, and it's been that way for a while, then you're probably in the wrong place and you need to start looking for something else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you heard it from Andrew, friends. It's good. It's, again, for me, it's amazing to get to ask this question of other people and have them answer it. Everybody answers it differently. There are some themes that run through the answers, but everybody's got their own perspective, their own take on it. And you just added to it. And I appreciate that very much. Andrew, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I'm glad that you agreed to come on and chat about the work you do, what motivates and inspires you. You've been a busy guy lately with your writing and your appearances on the radio. And so I think it's cool that I could take you through an experience that probably isn't as stressful as those ones. And maybe stressful isn't the right word, but I think you get my gist that we could just kind of chill out and talk.
Yeah, no, it's certainly more relaxed, but yeah, those things are stressful, and this hasn't been stressful at all. It's great to one of the frustrations is sometimes you don't have the time to speak freely and say all the things that you want to say, and so it's nice to have this kind of format where I can properly explain what's on my mind. It's great. Yes.
Yeah, and I appreciate it, and I'm sure the listeners will as well. But like I said, I'm lucky, dude. I know you outside of this, so I'm blessed for that. And I appreciate your friendship and your collegiality. And like I said, one day I'll be knocking on your door saying, hey, I've got this idea or this thought, and I want to bounce it off of you, knowing full well what you're going to do to me in return. I'm not trying to make it sound like a negative thing. I'm just making it sound like it will be an experience that's authentic and honest. And so I always know, that like when I send people your way, like people have said to me, you know, I'm interested in this or that. And I say, well, you might want to chat with Andrew Campbell. Like I know that you give 100% every time. And so that I think that's wonderful about you. Not everybody does that. You definitely set the bar high. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. I think it's a very important thing for everyone to have is a place where they can go to say dumb things. You know, like to have people they can talk to and kind of go, now I'm thinking this, what do you think? And all that kind of stuff. And to be able to just say whatever's there, no matter how silly it is, and have people reflect back on it. I mean, I think that's one of the things I really appreciate about the CEMF group that we're in is mm-hmm. that's a group of people who I feel like I can go there and it's a private group, and I can say whatever's on my mind, no matter how stupid it is. And suddenly, sometimes it's just the process of me putting it out there that I get to go, yeah, that's a dumb thing. I should not think that, or I should reconsider that, or whatever. Or someone in the group will say to me, yeah, no, you're way off on that, dude. I think that's an important thing for all of us to have as reflective practitioners, is a group of people who we can say dumb things to.
I agree 100%. It's funny you use the word dumb, because it's just weird how different people define that word. Like, I don't even know how to explain what I'm thinking right now, which is pretty cool. It's a cool feeling. I get what you're saying. It's just a place of trust, right? Like, I could go in there and I could say something, quote unquote, dumb, and I'm not going to be bothered by the responses I get from you guys, because it's just going to be, that's just the way it is. I feel like you do accept it as part of that group, and it's a group of heavy thinking guys who are all a little bit different in their approach. And sometimes we need that. And it's nice to have that safe place where you, it's okay if, you know, you tell me my idea is really stupid, or however you might phrase that, because it's not going to bother me personally. It's going to be like, I went there because I know what I'm going to get there, and what I'm going to get there is really appreciated. One little side note that you kind of clicked in my brain. Lately, I've been getting a lot of questions and connection about 3D printing and kind of the road that my students and I have been on since starting working with 3D printing, and all the awesome stuff that goes with that. And when I tell people the story of how it came to be, they always look so shocked. And it's because when I first introduced my idea, it was to one of my mentors, who's now a retired principal. But this guy, one of my cheerleaders, but he also pushes back. But I remember saying to him, we were sitting having coffee. I said, I've got this great idea. I want to throw it past you. This is going to be my next big thing in terms of like what I want to do in my classroom and how I want to help my kids think critically and like really move them into the 21st century, like more than just what 21st century learning is. Like, I want to throw them into an area of life that is going to become normal in the next 15 years kind of thing. And so he's like, okay, go ahead and talk. And I said, here's my idea. And I talked about 3D printing and design thinking and bringing ideas to life. And you can imagine, like, I was on fire. I was feeling great. I was like totally into what I was saying. And he looked at me after I was done and he said, nobody's ever going to buy that idea. Nobody's ever going to fund you. Nobody's ever like, what are you thinking? Like, this is, he's like, I know you're kind of a modern guy, but like, this is like over the top ridiculous. And I said, really? That's your perspective on this? And he said, yeah. I said, okay, cool. Let's move on to the next topic then. And I went ahead and did everything I said I was going to do. And that dumb idea has turned into one of the funnest experiences I've been a part of with a group of students. And the best part of all of it is watching their growth, watching their motivation, watching them fail moment after moment and pick themselves back up and keep going, because they are me sitting across the table from their mentor telling their stupid ideas to that person who's saying it's never going to happen and it's not even phasing them. That has been the most rewarding thing over the past 2 years for me. And so when you talk about being able to share these dumb ideas, it's like, that's where the magic is, because either people say something to you to keep you going, or people say something to you to help you readjust yourself because you realize that there's something flawed in your approach or idea. So no matter what, you're benefiting in those safe spaces. So thanks for taking me there, Andrew.
Yeah. I think that's a really important thing. When we have more time or another time, I'll share one of the best things I ever did. But it was when I realized that the thing that fosters deep understanding is admitting that you don't know what you're talking about and having to go back and figure it out again. And it was an exercise that I would go through with my students. But yeah, I think that that process of saying, this is what I want and this is what I want to do, and it doesn't make any sense, and then having to go back and figure it out, that's what drives the deep understanding for us as much as for our kids. I mean, I don't think it's a different process just because we're adults or teachers. I think it's the same process exactly.
Perfect. That this means that we're going to have you on again. Not sure what episode it will be, but it will be fun to have you again if you're willing to do it.
I'd love to. Yeah, anytime. Anytime you need me.
Awesome. Well, you enjoy the rest of your time this evening. And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
So probably two things. I do have a blog. It's andrewscampbell.com. Andrew S. Campbell is all one. But if that's too hard, probably hit me up on Twitter at acampbell99.
Awesome. Thanks, Andrew, and we'll be in touch soon.
I look forward to it. Thanks a lot for asking, Roland.